Let's go ahead and open our Bibles to Ezra chapter number 8, and we'll pick up on verse 21, get a little bit of our background again. This is all happening in the spring of 457 BC, where Ezra has secured a decree from King Artaxerxes of the Medo-Persian Empire to go to Jerusalem and further implement the laws of God and to establish more strongly the religious practices and the cultural practices of the Jewish people inside their promised land. And so this is what Ezra says, verse 21. Then I proclaimed a fast there at the river Ahava, that we might humble ourselves before our God to seek from him a safe journey for ourselves, our children, and all our goods. For I was ashamed to ask the king for a band of soldiers and horsemen to protect us against the enemy on our way, since we had told the king, quote, the hand of our God is for good on all who seek him, and the power of his wrath is against all who forsake him, end quote. So we fasted and implored our God for this, and he listened to our entreaty. So Ezra proclaims a fast on the 10th day of the first Jewish month, and they are asking God to give them a safe journey for them and their family members and for their goods, because he'd already said that God is the one that takes care of his own. Then we have a Sabbath rest that we know happened in that particular year on the 11th day of the first month. And then the 12th day of the month rolls around. And that's the day on which apparently they are going to leave and head off on their 1,500-mile approximate 3-month journey to the promised land. Verse 24, Ezra further reports, then I set aside 12 of the leading priests, Sherebiah, Hashabiah, and 10 of their kinsmen with them. And I weighed out to them the silver and the gold and the vessels, the offering for the house of our God that the king and his counselors and his lords and all Israel there present had offered. So now he's going to put the valuables into the custody of these 12 guys. Verse 26, I weighed out into their hand 650 talents of silver. And so each talent is 75 pounds. So we are talking about literally tons of silver. And silver vessels worth 200 talents. So if you were to think of their purchase value, then we're talking about many millions of dollars, and 100 talents of gold, 20 bowls of gold worth 1,000 derricks. Again, we're talking about weighted items here, but it's the ultimate value is millions of dollars for all of this. And some of the individual pieces have got to be many, many lifetimes of worth. Two vessels of fine, bright bronze as precious as gold. And I said to them, after putting all this stuff into their care, you are holy to he who is, and the vessels are holy, and the silver and the gold are a freewill offering to he who is, the God of your fathers, which means that even the raw material, the silver and the gold, is also holy to God. It's set aside specifically for him. Verse 29, guard them and keep them until you weigh them before the chief priests and the Levites and the heads of the fathers' houses in Israel at Jerusalem within the chambers of the house of he who is. So what we're actually seeing here is accountability. Ezra helps these guys account for exactly how much of value and how many items are being put into their custody. And he has it all documented, And then that document is going to go with him. And he will hand that document over to the priests and the Levites and others of authority at Jerusalem. And then when they start unloading all of this stuff from probably the carts that are on, that these things are on, they will have an exact accounting. So nothing should go missing. Every ounce has to be accounted for. Every item has to be accounted for, because that's just the proper thing. Verse 30. So the priests and the Levites took over the weight of the silver and the gold and the vessels to bring them to Jerusalem to the house of our God. Then we departed from the river Ahava on the 12th day of the first month to go to Jerusalem. So now we begin the trip. The hand of our God was on us, and he delivered us from the hand of the enemy and from ambushes on the way. We don't have any details, but probably some supernatural things happened on the way that protected this wagon train, if you will, because we're talking about tens of thousands of people that are probably all told going on this trip, along with all of their probably several thousands of wagons with their personal possessions in, plus the wagons that are carrying all the valuables of the house of God. That's a pretty tasty target for road bandits. And so God, no doubt, intervened along the way, and we just don't have the details. Verse 32. We came to Jerusalem, and there we remained 3 days. Now, we've already been told that they arrived in the fifth month of the Jewish year. So 3 months travel, a little over 3 months travel, and a lot of rests along the way. And it says that on the fourth day after their arrival, within the house of our God, the silver and the gold and the vessels were weighed into the hands of Meremoth the priest, son of Uriah, and with him was Eleazar the son of Phinehas, and with them were the Levites, Jozabad the son of Yeshua, and Noadiah the son of Benui. And the whole was counted and weighed, and the weight of everything was recorded. So everything was delivered exactly as described. So nothing was lost along the way. At that time, those who had come from captivity, the returned exiles, offered burnt offerings to the God of Israel, 12 bulls for all Israel, 96 rams, 77 lambs, and as a sin offering, 12 male goats. So now that they've been there for a few days, on the fourth day of the fifth month, which by my reckoning would have taken place on a Friday, so getting ready for the Sabbath. So it's kind of like the end of the week sort of worship service. It says that they gave all of these sacrifices as a sin offering as well as a thank offering for their trip. All this was a burnt offering to He Who Is. They also delivered the king's commissions to the king's satraps and to the governors of the province beyond the river, and they aided the people and the house of God. So everybody has arrived safe and sound, and everything has been accounted for, and we are ready to settle in and get started with the work that is in front of them. Now, as I already indicated, by my calculations, this trip took place in the 137th sabbatical year. Now, sabbatical years are years, it's the seventh year of every work cycle. The seventh year, you did not plant, you did not harvest, you did not do anything counted as regular work unless it was absolutely essential. So the priests had to do their work on schedule, and you had to take care of the basic needs of your animals. But other than that, you were supposed to take the year off. No work. That ran from the seventh month of each Jewish year until the end of the following sixth month. So 12 months off. So when Ezra and his people arrived, it was a time of rest. So none of them worked. But once the seventh month rolled around again in 457, that is in the late summer, getting ready for the fall, then they were able to work again. And I believe that there is a record that Ezra began the new work cycle by telling his people, let's get these walls built. And so in Ezra chapter number 4, verses 13 and 14, we read this. Now be it known to the king that if this city is rebuilt and the walls finished, they will not pay tribute, custom, or toll, and the royal revenue will be impaired. Now, because we eat the salt of the palace, and it's not fitting for us to witness the king's dishonor, therefore we send and inform the king. Now, why am I reading that? Because that is part of a letter sent by the non-Jewish officials of the lower, below the river province, shortly after Ezra arrived. They were complaining, hey, these guys are building walls, and you need to tell them to stop if you want to protect your reputation, because all they're doing is they're trying to prepare for rebellion. And we know by the rest of the information in that context that when Artaxerxes got that information, he sent Ezra an order to stop working on the walls until he gave him specific permission. And we know that this same king will give specific permission to rebuild the walls to Nehemiah about a decade and a half later. So, my point is, we have good evidence that Ezra started rebuilding the walls in the fall of 457 BC. And that is going to kick off the countdown clock to the Messiah, the 77 cycles, the 490 years until the Messiah comes and is cut off. That's all from Daniel chapter number 9. Now, at this point, I want us to go to Ezra chapter 9 and see something else that Ezra runs into now that he has arrived as the new Jewish governor of the Jewish people in the Promised Land area. Ezra chapter 9, verse 1. After these things had been done, what things? The arrival and the accounting for all of the materials that they brought with them. After these things had been done, the officials approached me and said, "The people of Israel and the priests and the Levites have not separated themselves from the peoples of the lands with their abominations, from the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Jebusites, the Ammonites, the Moabites, the Egyptians, and the Amorites. For they have taken some of their daughters to be wives for themselves and for their sons, so that the holy race, that is, the holy offspring, the holy seed, has mixed itself with the peoples of the lands. And in this faithfulness, the hand of the officials and the chief men have been foremost." Now, what's going on here? Ezra is not the first and Ezra's companions are not the first to return out of Babylon. Remember, I told you that the temple has been rebuilt for 60 years. So it's been 75 years, roughly, since Zerubbabel and Joshua the high priest and the first tens of thousands of ethnic Israelis came back to the land. So 75 years there have been Jews living in the land. Now, there not been a huge presence, but there have been enough of them that they've started raising new generations. And Ezra has just been told by the people he's arrived with that have found out about it, hey, some of these people have been marrying non-Israelis. Now, the problem is not genetics. This is not a matter of racism here. The Israeli people had been told, don't marry outside of Israel, because that was the way you guaranteed you did not marry outside the faith. Because any non-Israelis that converted to the faith of Israel would then become honorary Israelis during some period of time. And so they wouldn't be thought of as foreigners anymore. They would have been proselytes, yes, at the very beginning, but eventually they would have been thought of as honorary Jews. But if Israelis married people that had not converted, that was a big no-no. And that's apparently what's happened during the last 75 years, is a whole bunch of people have married pagan spouses and have permitted those pagan spouses to carry on with their pagan worship and to even teach that worship to their kids. And so we've got a mess on our hands here in defense of the pure Jewish faith. And that's why Ezra immediately gets upset. Verse number 3, as soon as I heard this, I tore my garments. So he rips his clothing in this display of grief. I ripped my garment and my cloak, and I pulled hair from my head and beard and sat appalled. So he is so upset about this, he even apparently pulls out little patches of his beard and his hair to show how grief-stricken he is. And then he sits down despondent and no doubt praying about this. Verse 4, then all who trembled at the words of the God of Israel, and we're talking about the written, inspired word of God here, which specifically said, don't intermarry with non-believers. Then all those who trembled at the words of the God of Israel because of the faithlessness of the returned exiles gathered around me while I sat appalled until the evening sacrifice. So the morning sacrifice happens right around 9 o'clock in the morning. Evening sacrifice happens right around 3 o'clock in the afternoon. So he has spent his day upset and thinking about how this does not bode well for the reason that he's here. He is here to further strengthen the Jewish faith in the Jewish homeland. And now he finds out that it has been abandoned wholesale, not just simply by the common people, but by many of the people in leadership. So what's he going to do about it? Verse 5, at the evening sacrifice, I rose from my fasting with my garment and my cloak torn and fell upon my knees and spread out my hands to the God, my hands to he who is my God, saying, so let's listen in to his prayer at the evening or afternoon sacrifice time. Oh my God, I am ashamed and blush to lift my face to you, my God, for our iniquities have risen higher than our heads, and our guilt has mounted up to the heavens. For the day, from the days of our fathers to this day, we have been in great guilt. For all iniquities, we, our kings, our priests, have been given into the hand of the kings of the lands, to the sword, to captivity, to plundering, and to utter shame, as it is to this day. So he's remembering history. He is remembering that all the bad things that have happened in Israeli history, including the exile itself that they're actually just now starting to recover from, all of the bad things that has ever happened is because of their sin, because of going against the covenant. Verse number 8. But now, for a brief moment, favor has been shown by He who is our God to leave us a remnant and to give us a secure hold within this holy place, that our God may brighten our eyes and grant us a little reviving in our slavery. This idea that they had gone into exile into being the servants of somebody else. Some of them were literal slaves, but others were just simply having to work for non-Israelis. And that was shameful. They should have been in their homeland, but they weren't. But now, in the last 75 years, they've returned, and it had this bright light that they thought was going to lead to a total revival. But now that's looking like it's getting kicked in the head. Verse 9, for we are slaves, and yet our God has not forsaken us in our slavery, but has extended to us His steadfast love before the kings of Persia to grant us some reviving, that is, this renewal. And then he gives specifics, to set up the house of our God to repair its ruins. That is, to actually rebuild the temple. The temple that he's worshiping in is only 60 years old. So that's part of the evidence that God has given them this window of reprieve. And to give us protection in Judah and Jerusalem. And this is one of the places, folks, that I have to object to our English Standard Version that is usually so very good. The word protection here is actually the Hebrew word for wall. And I want to stress that because I've already told you we have evidence, and this is just further evidence of it, that Ezra has ordered the walls of Jerusalem to be rebuilt. Now, they won't get finished under this decree of his, but it will be the kickoff to the prophecy of Daniel chapter number 9, which said that there would be a decree that would include the rebuilding of the walls of Jerusalem. So in his prayer here, Ezra actually mentions one of the glints of hope, one of the bright lights of the moment, was that they were in the process of building the wall right then. Verse number 10. And now, O our God, what shall we say after this? For we have forsaken your commandments, which you have commanded by your servants, the prophets, saying, the land that you are entering to take possession of it is a land impure with the impurity of the peoples of the lands, with their abominations that have filled it from one end to end with their uncleanness. Therefore, do not give your daughters to their sons, neither take their daughters for your sons, and never seek their peace or prosperity, that you may be strong and eat the good of the land and leave it for an inheritance to your children forever. Now, that's kind of a summary of many passages in Scripture from the time of Moses forward, that the Israeli people were never to intermarry with people of different faiths. of pagan peoples that were still worshiping other gods and goddesses. Because if they did that, what would more than likely happen, and did in fact happen, the faith of those pagan peoples would overwhelm the faith of the Israelis. And they would start worshiping those gods and goddesses, and that would bring God's judgment. So they were never supposed to freely cooperate in the worship rituals of other peoples. And they were never to allow their kids to intermarry outside the faith. Verse number 13. And after all that has come upon us for our evil deeds and for our great guilt, seeing that you, our God, have punished us less than our iniquities deserved and have given us such a remnant of this. So he acknowledges, you know, you didn't have to be so gracious to bring us back at this point, but you did. But what's happened? Shall we break this commandment again and intermarry with the peoples who practice these abominations? Would you not be angry with us until you consumed us so that there should not be a remnant nor any to escape? So here we go again. And you would be right to blot us out because we don't seem to have learned our lesson. Verse 15, oh, he who is the God of Israel, you are just, for we are left a remnant that has escaped as it is today. Behold, we are before you in our guilt, for none can stand before you because of this. So he freely offers this prayer of confession on behalf of his people. And chapter 10 sets us up for tomorrow. While Ezra prayed and made confession, weeping and casting himself down before the house of God, a very great assembly of men, women, and children gathered to him out of Israel, for the people wept bitterly. So he sets the standard, he sets the example, and they follow in confessing the sin of Israel.